This episode of Popcast is brought to you by Random House, publishers of Last Hope Island by New York Times bestselling author Lynn Olson. Hailed a rip-roaring saga by Eric Larson, Last Hope Island recounts an untold World War II story about the perilous days when the British joined forces with European exiles and stood together to combat the mightiest military force in history. Last Hope Island is available now wherever books are sold.
Popcast is supported in part by HelloFresh, the meal kit delivery service dedicated to making cooking fun, easy, and convenient, and delivered right to your door. For $30 off your first week of deliveries, visit HelloFresh.com and enter promo code NYTPOP when you subscribe.
Yeah. We all mine.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your trusted influencer, but secretly we're out to get you, of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
To everybody that be living it up, we say. To all my ladies that be living it up. Come on, baby, this is your typical, everyday, one night thing. It's a physical, I'ma love you tonight, gang. Look, calling your name, go jump on in the range and roll over. I just really wanted to hold you. Time get to know you. That's a good chick. Before it's all over, I'ma meet this chick. Probably treat this chick more better. Cause if you ain't no thugs and ladies go together. Popping my collar, partner, who in the spot? Baby, ruling the spot. In the mug, in the watch, up me. Half of y'all hate me, half y'all love me. The ones that hate me only hate me cause they don't trust me. And they say I'm lucky. You think I got time to blow all this dough and do all these shows? On flight in the llama, charging white robes. Uh oh, another episode.
Do I do?
To everybody that be living it up, we say.
What?
Oh, we're living it up. Your man Ja Rule is living it up. But you know who's not living it up? Are the thousands of people who tried to go to the Fyre Festival. Today, for the first half of Popcast, we're going to talk about all the things that went wrong at Fyre Festival. And on the second half of the Popcast, we're going to focus on some festivals that get it more or less right. And that's where we're going to bring you all the music. I have three writers with me who all collaborated on a big, big takedown and TikTok of what happened with the Fyre Festival. I have pop music reporter Joe Coscarelli.
I'm here.
I've got arts reporter Milena Rizek.
That's right. Here I am.
And music business reporter Ben Cesario.
Hi.
It's a big story. So you got big writers working on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole squad, the whole gang's
this
in here.
This is what we do at the New York Times. Just, you know, we put all of our muscle.
Squad up.
We do some investigating.
That's right.
So the fact that all three of you contributed to the story lets me know that not only is it a heater, and it is a heater with a lot of details, but it lets me know that there was a lot of things to uncover, more than just one reporter in a week could do.
More than we even thought, I think.
Absolutely. Every day Joe and I started working on this, we thought, there cannot be any more insane details. Like, the insanity is over. We've reached the peak, and yet every day there was something else.
So before we get to that, who wants to talk me through what Fyre Festival was supposed to be?
Ben?
It was supposed to be like the ultimate anti-upping festival of this age of festivals. It was going to be super glamorous thing in the Bahamas where you could spend tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars on a special, super luxurious cabin with your buddies, and there was going to be gourmet food. There was going to be a treasure hunt where there was $1 million in cash and jewels hidden on the island.
Land?
And they were going to end
up giving you
the
land.
Grand giving prize, away land.
In the Bahamas?
Grand prize the was grand advertised prize was the ability to be near an influencer. That was the real grand prize.
Yeah. And that's the whole other side is the influencers, the Kendall Jenner and
yes.
Bella Hadid and stuff. So
you guys
it was something sold.
The...
I think Milena put it best when we were like starting on this. This was kind of like the ultimate Instagram festival. It was like the Instagram version of that. It was just a vision of like people in bikinis on the beach, but there was nothing there.
Like
ultimately.
If you're sitting around at a meatpacking district club,
bottle service club.
And you're talking to your bros.
Know what that's like, but
you're talking
sure.
to your bros, and you're just you know you're a little tipsy on yeah. I don't know what these people drink, but you
Ciroc
know,
apple,
yeah,
maybe.
And you're just spitballing like, and then we'll have yachts, and then we'll have private planes, and then we'll have
Ja
Kanye.
Rule. Ja Rule. Yeah.
This is Ja Rule at the table.
Oh yeah. My bad.
Yeah, your Ja Rule impression needs work, Joe.
But that's what Fyre Festival was basically like a near parody.
So what ended up happening is a bunch of people managed to get the first chartered flights to the Bahamas.
A handful, yeah.
Only to find that it was a little bit like the Todd P thing I went to in Monterrey, Mexico a bunch of years ago.
Except that was supposed to be that
way. Like, no, I'm not even sure that was the case. But where it was like, the tents aren't here and the food's not set up. And if you paid, you know, $9,000 to hang out within the vicinity of Bella Hadid, you probably don't even know who Todd P is and nor are into his aesthetic. Shouts to Todd P, though.
These are different worlds.
All respect to Todd P. There is a villain, Billy McFarland. Joe, you had some interactions, I think, with Billy
right. McFarland. So the way most of the world discovered Fyre Festival, I think, was they woke up on a Friday morning a couple weeks ago, and you know, there's hashtags and there's photos of these disaster relief tents and this like floppy piece of American cheese, and you know,
whoever took that picture should get a Pulitzer.
a half-built concierge stand. And what had happened, it seemed initially, was, you know, there was, I guess, a storm Wednesday night going into Thursday when the first guests were supposed to arrive at this festival. And it became, you know, a meme, a viral story about, haha, these millennials paying all this money for glamour and Instagram glitz. And then they show up, of course, and it stinks, basically.
Yeah.
So that day, you know,
which made it a like beautiful internet meme.
Yeah.
Right? Not only was it just a catastrophe, but it was a catastrophe that affected well-off millennial kids who said it was the worst day of their lives.
Yeah, and no one got hurt.
Super schadenfreude.
Yeah, no one got hurt. You know,
yeah, they all were able to get off the island successfully.
It was all jokes that day, basically. But that afternoon, Friday, I got on the phone with Billy McFarland, who was the founder of this company, Fyre Media, which then became Fyre Festival, along with his pal Ja Rule. And he told me this story about them crash landing in the Bahamas in a private plane, or taking an emergency landing and discovering this beautiful land and having to stage a festival there.
Must have to have a festival here.
Right. He told me that it combined his three biggest passions: internet programming, tech, rap music, and the ocean. So that's the kind of guy we're dealing with. So he was, you know, he was very apologetic.
So this festival was basically just an Instagram bio turned into a festival.
Exactly.
And a Tinder bio
exactly.
turned into a festival.
And Billy McFarland, he's a 25-year-old, as we said, sort of budding tech entrepreneur. And he admitted, you know, we got in way over our heads here, basically. He was like, we set up on this island and it didn't have infrastructure and we needed water and we needed places for people to live.
Yeah. Crazy.
It was, you know, he was shelter food. And he was like, you know, we never made a music festival before. Like, this is harder than we thought.
Right. So basically, you guys then spent, from starting with that phone call, working forwards a couple weeks, you guys have all the tea, so much tea about this festival. So, like, part of me wants the TikTok and part of me just wants the juicy stuff.
Like, it's all the same.
Okay. So tell, like,
but
why
let me just say
this...
one more thing. Like, there's a juicy TikTok, mm-hmm. like the, you know, the crazy business practices and the stories that we uncovered about just how this all came. They're insane and they're hilarious. But I also thought that we found something pretty important here, was that there were, especially in the Bahamas, there were a lot of people who worked on this who got stiffed.
Mm-hmm.
Ordinary people. There was a caterer. Yep. There was a carpenter whose lights were turned off because he was never paid. And I thought it was an illustration of just how putting on something like a big music festival really does involve lots of people from many different walks of life working on this. The agents, the bands, the people who supply the lights and the stage equipment, and the carpenters and the caterers.
And the people who feed the people who are building the stage.
Yeah.
You know, it takes a village, literally.
When there's a catastrophe at this level, it really does have a really huge impact on those people.
And especially a place that, from what I can gather from your reporting, doesn't host music festivals very often.
Yeah,
there's not
people.
An infrastructure for it. And so there is this sort of imperialist streak of like, we're basically going to dive bomb into this country. We're going to make a bunch of things happen and we're going to treat local people poorly. And then when it falls apart, we're going to shrug and go, eh.
We're back in New York.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think the starting place for this was, we were sort of like, who is the guy who was able to convince all of these different people that he could pull something like this off? Like, this is a large scale event for even the first day when, you know, we discovered this thing, it was already clear, like, they gave themselves maybe 4 months to do something that required maybe more like a year or two
and
of
then
planning.
We realized that they actually only got on the ground like less than 6 weeks before the thing right. was supposed to go off.
So we're thinking about this guy, Billy McFarland, and, you know, there he has a trail out there in public. There's a New York Times style story about him from 2013 when he created this company called Magnesis, which was like a faux American Express Black Card, which didn't really function as a credit card. So you start to notice that there's a pattern here of this guy sort of presenting an idea that looks really glossy up front, and then as soon as you maybe like scratch a little bit under the surface,
scams.
Allegedly.
Joe and I just kept saying scams. Our mantra for this guy was over promise, under deliver. That's mm-hmm. what he did over and over again.
Those text messages you guys published, some of his text messages, which I thought were really rich.
Like, those are my favorite part of the story, I think.
This is one of the first details that Malena got when we were like, all right, there's probably a story here with this guy.
Yeah, actually, I'll say also that this is a story that we got enormous volume of tips on.
Yes.
It's people who have been, you know, burned by this guy probably, or his business practices, just writing in and saying, I've got a story to tell. And let me just say, on behalf of all of us, probably, we encourage that.
We're still here.
Get your Tor server up.
and so we got a series of text messages that someone who had been a member of Magnesis briefly got sent from Billy, even though she never responded to any of these messages. He kept sending these texts, these weird offers of like, you know, I'm going away for the weekend, have my Maserati with a driver for whatever X amount of money. And we didn't get to put this in the story, but she actually got all of those texts after she'd already canceled her membership to Magnesis. So they had no professional connection.
The hoverboard one too.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, selling hoverboards, selling ASAP Rocky tickets. Yeah.
While also selling placement in Ja Rule songs.
Great.
Lyrics.
So great. Yeah. Honestly, I feel
$450. Like, is that good?
It's a bargain. I think it's a bargain.
To get mentioned in a Ja Rule song, I feel like
the problem is he was promising that it was
in October. Just I just want to say, my birthday is in October. If you guys are thinking about what's
still an active offer.
Yeah, if you guys are thinking about what to
get. I don't know
what
the price is.
The problem is that he was promising it would be a hit, which that was the real dubious part.
Right.
And I think under notice in these texts, and maybe it wasn't in the ones we published, but he was also offering the same deal for a Troy Ave song. So I'll just put that out there. So Ja Rule or Troy Ave, take your pick.
Group moment of silence. Okay, moving on.
the most sort of ominous or telling detail about those texts is the last text that we had was in 2016 was an offer for a spot in the Bahamas.
Yes, like this saying guy was he was going for the weekend to the Bahamas. Yeah. So
there's one more piece to this story.
Brilliant.
Which at one point we got an audio tape of a meeting after the whole thing fell apart, and they're back in New York sort of running through what went wrong. And one of the employees says, hey, what's with the FBI approaching us?
So-and-so got approached by the FBI. Should we be worried, basically?
So that led to reporting on a federal investigation, and it's being headed by a prosecutor for the Southern District of New York in the Complex Frauds and Cybercrime Division.
I think that's right.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Heavy sounding. You know, this is so.
Especially because this seemed like a pretty simple fraud.
Not a complex fraud.
Yeah, just like an expert opinion. As frauds go, probably didn't seem that complicated.
And there's multiple instances of fraud that they are potentially investigating, wire, mail.
Securities fraud, because, you know, he was selling this to investors. And
very angry investors.
Some of those
now.
Investors are quite angry and are accusing him of cooking the books and misrepresenting their assets and that sort of thing. The kind of thing that, you know, you do not want the federal government looking into.
One of the questions that we would have asked Billy if we'd gotten a full sit-down interview with him is, you know, one of the problems with this is just the distance, as we said in the story, the distance of the festival from the reality from what they were advertising. So, and all the changes they made to their website as they were upping and upping and upping the stakes with all of their crazy packages, they could have at some point just said, hey guys, you know, left turn, we're doing this a different way. And
it could have been a normal music festival. And they might have been able to pull it off.
They probably would have pulled it off. You know, they certainly would have pulled it off for the second weekend.
Yeah. If anyone really wants to get deep on this, you can go on the Wayback Machine and see a few different versions of the website as it existed basically from December through April.
But there's one side of this that I kind of like, which is kind of like startup culture where, you know, he's a tech entrepreneur, and part of that whole world is like bootstrapping and faking it till you make it. And if they had pulled off the festival, even if the festival wasn't terrific.
Wasn't perfect.
If it wasn't perfect, but they had done it, I think we would be telling a different story.
It was
this
scrappy kid.
Yeah, can you believe that this Mark Zuckerberg type, you know, paid his staff in cash and, you know, hoodwinked some investors along the way. You know, we're used to that kind of a story. And if it turns out okay, we want to celebrate that person.
And then sort of perversely, you guys have on the recording Ja Rule saying sort of a corollary to that, which is like, the whole world knows Fire's name now.
Yeah, so this was which is true. A bit unfortunate.
Facts, as we say.
I think it's fair to say in a lot of our reporting, people believe that Ja Rule may not have known all of what was going on. We'll leave that to the authorities to sort out.
Mm-hmm. But
it's not fraud.
It's false advertising.
Not fraud. So we got two tapes, a tape from the Tuesday after the festival in which Ja Rule says it's not fraud. And, you know, Billy says, we're trying to sort this out. We're going to hire a financial advisor. Then a few days later, you get Billy coming back in front of the same employees. This tape has been published by Vice. You can find it online of him saying, you know, you guys aren't going to be paid for a while. Don't touch your books. Like, leave all your emails on your computer, basically saying, you know, people are sniffing around this. Our lawyers are going to need it. And on the second tape, it's a lot more subdued than the sort of cheerleading that Ja Rule was doing even a few days earlier. So I think this thing was, every day, it was getting worse for them.
We should say, to go back to Ben's point, like, for the people on the island, it's still a disaster, you know? I mean, the carpenter that we quote in the story is the guy who's out $5,000 and doesn't have his utilities turned on. He's not alone. There's literally were hundreds of people working on the festival.
Right,
like,
and
this,
if there are bankruptcy, if there are any proceedings where people get paid out of this, they're probably going to be at the end of the line.
Yeah, and it's not only like local Bahamian workers, but there are American companies that brought their gear over there, and their
and
stuff
it's still
is
stuck
still
as of,
stuck in
as
customs.
Of when we were, yeah,
because of unpaid fees by Fyre Festival, basically they're punishing sort of everyone involved. And Blink-182 said that some of their gear is still in the Bahamas. I mean, the ripples on this thing are just insane.
Yeah, we kind of thought of it as this trail of havoc that started in the Bahamas and went all the way up the eastern seaboard and across the country down to the west too.
All right, enough negative things about Firefest. Let's leave on an optimistic note and a Bahamian note. Let's listen to a Bahamian classic, Ronnie Butler's Burma Road.
He wear $95 alligator skin shoes. You're a lousy dog. Listen, I remember when we used to go to high mass Sunday morning wearing high top tennis with no socks on. And God help you if it rain, cause toe jam, it'll kill you. Listen, let me tell you. You got to go in the bush, over the hill, down Burma Road. That's where it's at. Believe it or not, folks, that's where it's at. I know most of you tourists out there don't know what I'm talking about. Well, we're talking about the Bahamian thing. Yes, indeed. All right, y'all. Going down Burma Road.
We'll be back.
This episode of Popcast is brought to you by Random House, publishers of Last Hope Island by New York Times bestselling author Lynn Olson. Hailed a rip-roaring saga by Eric Larson, Last Hope Island recounts an untold World War II story about the perilous days when the British joined forces with European exiles and stood together to combat the mightiest military force in history. Last Hope Island is available now wherever books are sold.
Meu choro não é nada nem de carnaval. É lágrima de samba na ponta dos pés. A multidão avança como um vendaval. Me joga na avenida que não sei qual é. Pirata e super-homem cantam o calor. Um peixe amarelo beija minha mão. As asas de um anjo soltas pelo chão.
Na chuva de confetes deixo a minha dor. Na avenida deixei lá a pele preta e a minha voz. Na avenida deixei lá a minha fala, a minha opinião, a minha casa, a minha solidão. Joguei do alto do terceiro andar, quebrei a cara e me livrei do resto dessa vida.
Okay, you were just listening to Elza Soares. That was Woman at the End of the World. And Elza was one of the artists who was playing in the past month as part of the Red Bull Music Academy series of shows, a sort of quasi-festival that spans a month and also spans the globe. And I wanted to, in part two of our exclusively festival coverage podcast, to talk a little bit about how things don't always go wrong. And to do that, John Perales, chief pop music critic of the New York Times.
Hi there.
Giovanni Russinello, who writes about jazz and other things for the New York Times.
Hey there.
And we all went to some Red Bull events, and JP has also been, as JP does, in these trenches at various festivals. So let's actually start by going back a little bit to the past couple of years. John, you remember we wrote a
A manifesto.
We wrote a screed.
We put our fists in the air.
We screeded.
Which was hard to type. But we basically said these festivals that are, well, not that bad. But these festivals that are basically like shopping malls of whoever is within the radius agreement at that time of the month.
Yes.
Right. We're not going there. There's no story there. It's a laundry list.
It's a wrap. It's done. Y'all are canceled. So we basically stopped covering a lot of the centrist festivals. That's not to say we'll never cover them again. If they become newsworthy, well, I'll get on a plane just like everybody else. But
Flight of the Caribbean.
Sure. Why not? That would have been worth it. Can you imagine? Yeah, my IG stories would have been lit.
Oh, man. Missed a scoop.
It's true. So, but we'll go if, you know, when Beyonce, we were going to cover Coachella, or at least the Beyonce performance. We'll be there next year, I assume. But generally speaking, for those kind of grab bag festivals, we decided let's take a pass. These are festivals that are pretty homogenized. Mm-hmm. You can go to something in Washington that looks a lot like something in Minneapolis, looks a lot like something in Florida, looks a lot like something in Texas. There's no regional culture. There's no ideology behind them. The only ideology is getting a bunch of people under on the same plot of land and marketing them from the same companies.
Now that's what I call a festival.
That's right. I mean, you know, volume 12.
Volume 69.
What a smash.
68, 64.
However, we have chosen to not do that. Which is one of the reasons we have chosen to cover some other festivals. And we're going to talk about Red Bull Music Academy, and we're going to talk about Moogfest. Let's start with Red Bull Music Academy, which Elza was playing at. One of the reasons that I have historically liked this sort of anti-festival festival is it feels like it's curated by people who have not just very good taste, but who understand how a live event can deliver a version of history. Mm. And that's something that I feel that if you're just booking touring musicians, no knock against that, but there's not an idea behind it. The Red Bull shows, historically, they feel like they come from a place of strong taste, strong musical affection, and also delivering a product that maybe that artist wouldn't ordinarily perform or deliver.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons that when it comes, I feel like we cover it, even in a post-covering festivals universe. So we all went to different shows. I probably went to five or six different things. Gio, I saw you out there with the notepad, getting it in. JP, I know you went to a couple things. What are some of the moments that stood out for you? Who went to Elza? You went to Elza.
I went to Elza's Forest.
Let's talk about that.
That whole thing was a moment that stood out. I often feel like this festival has in mind and at its heart what you're describing, but doesn't always get there.
Yep.
You can't always deliver a finished product without going through the process. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the times importing things that are really great conceptually can feel a little top down, a little dropped in. And if the venue doesn't work, if the crowd doesn't really get what they're seeing, you get this sort of smack of, I don't want to say cultural appropriation, maybe we'll call it cultural expropriation that doesn't work always. That being said, celebrating the music that they celebrate, which often goes so under-recognized, is a beautiful thing. Elza Soares, case in point, hasn't played in the United States for 25 years,
unreal.
Which is unbelievable because this woman is beyond royalty in Brazil. She's on stage when the curtains come back. She's sitting on a throne 6 feet above the ground in a gown that goes all the way to the floor almost. It's because of a back injury, but you wouldn't have known it. It seems like the starkest, most artist-driven choice there could be. She's commanding the entire place, and she's got this band of young Brazilian musicians playing kind of a mix of math rock and faro and all these kinds of things thrown together. And
these are the guys that call themselves Dirty Samba?
Partly they are. I think that the cats on the record were largely not there for the show. I think I counted two from the record that were actually at the show. But it was music from the record. What I'm referring to is last year's mm-hmm. A Woman at the End of the World, which mm-hmm. is a masterpiece. Kind of in that mode of the late Bobby Womack, Johnny Cash, Gil Scott-Heron.
But she's meaner than any of them.
But she's more, exactly. And with
she's
Gil,
tough.
He said, that's not really my record. You know, XL Records made that for me. This, she's all the way there. So anyway, you've got this weird mashup of rock, experimentalism, Brazilian traditionalism coming together, kind of like a David Byrne, you know, fever dream, but one that's totally owned by this legend of samba, Elza Soares. And there she is right now doing something completely fresh at 80 years old.
JP, you wrote about this record last year.
I did.
Talk to us about the record itself.
Well, it's what he said. I mean, it's all these things thrown together. It's the arrangements bristle, the voice bristles. Mm. She's carnal and she's mad and she's tough. And I'm sorry I didn't get to see her. I was out at another festival.
But this and this show was a slight outlier in the Red Bull framework because Red Bull tends to skew younger, tends to skew more dance oriented. Because part of what Red Bull does outside of the Red Bull Music Academy are these sort of long interviews with iconic figures.
Right.
So
yeah.
this performance building this feels a little bit more in that vein.
And what was cool is that the crowd was super young. The crowd was aware of her, was down with her. It was very packed, and it was people who, you know, you'd probably have about 25% of the crowd being over 40, but most of them were kids who probably got hip to her through this record or maybe if they're Brazilian kids through their parents or who knows, but it was a hungry crowd for mm-hmm. for what she was delivering, but it was a very young crowd.
In terms of elders this year, there was a conversation with Werner Herzog, which I did not get to go see. There was a conversation with Alvin Lucier, who's an experimental composer, and then a slightly younger elder. There was a long conversation with Teddy Riley talking about the history of New Jack Swing, which I went to go see, and I found fascinating. A lot of little details that he dropped about his song-making process, the bedroom where he made his first hits as a producer and for Guy, his group, and making songs with Michael Jackson on the Dangerous record. Great mm-hmm. conversation. And then, unexpectedly, that same night, there was a New Jack Swing-themed party that was supposed to be sort of a companion piece to the Teddy Riley talk. And I got there, and there no one was playing New Jack Swing. And I was, like, very vexed and, like, kind of aggravated. And then, just as I was thinking about leaving, in walks Teddy Riley, like with this like beam glow around him, and walked through the crowd, went to the DJ booth, set up his synthesizer, got the vocoder popping, and started doing a live set, which I don't think was advertised. And he did 20 or 25 minutes of straight hits, and it was very intense, and I felt very relieved that I didn't have to listen to any more Flo Rida records.
Even though I hate to for I cried as I walked out the door.
The door I cried.
Temptation is asking me to stay, but we've been through the same thing before. I can't believe that this is happening to us. We made vows to never depart.
But I have to say about Red Bull, one thing they're doing is they're getting the oral history of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go back to when hip-hop started, no one was listening to what these people had to say, and they're gathering all this knowledge now. A lot of it's online, a lot of it they've mm-hmm. transcribed the interviews. It's a great resource for material that is now being studied and curated and thought about, but
it's
high it could level have disappeared.
It's high-level corporate patronage.
Right. It's like bringing hip-hop down to the galleries in downtown mm-hmm. in the early 80s, right? It's Charlie Ahern and mm-hmm. that kind of vibe. But
I saw the Beastie Boys at the Kitchen.
There you go. But I think it is sort of a corporate need, quote-unquote, but there's a lot of ways to fulfill a corporate need. So I think even more complex is the relationship of the curator to the artist, because of course the corporation isn't pure, but neither is the curator,
sure,
right? So I think giving too much power to somebody who maybe comes in from outside and says, I have a great idea, is a peril, only if you don't also go to the artist and say, how's this idea work, and
yeah,
can you give me draft 2, 3, 4, and 5 of this idea, and then we'll figure it out.
Well,
you
that's
know what I mean?
And that's something where I think Red Bull tends to play right in that space where who we think of as commercially viable artists intersect with like tastemaker culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that intersects and overlaps a little bit fraught.
Yeah.
Because I think that it's possible that tastemakers will expect something of a commercially viable artist that commercially viable artist doesn't much care about or isn't right that interested in, but obviously a gig's a gig.
Right. The enthusiasm of the, it's like, it's kind of like our role as quote unquote critics, right?
Yes.
It's like our, we have to advocate for what gets audiences excited. But at the same time, if you're actually booking a show, the number one issue is what gets the artist excited. You know what I mean?
And because of that, I feel like I admire the challenge that the Red Bull curators sort of step up to take, but it doesn't always deliver.
Yeah, word.
But sometimes, you know, it does deliver. I went and saw the Music of Patrick Adams show. Mm-hmm. Who? Patrick Adams? is basically the first reaction. The second reaction is he's the songwriter, producer mm-hmm for Musique's Push Push in the Bush.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of these guys who, like, made disco work, who was the arranger, who greased the wheels for all these groups that came and went. And forged these incredible grooves. And here's this guy who's been toiling away in studios for 40 years, and they give him a big band. They get somebody to go back and reverse engineer all of his arrangements off of the old hits. They give him people who can play. They give him an evening at the Alhambra Ballroom in Harlem, which is a little echoey, but not so mm-hmm bad. And he's happy as a clam.
Yeah.
He is just thrilled. He's never been able to do this. You know, this is, he always wanted to go out and put, you know, play it with strings, play it with a big band, and Red Bull has finally given him that. So it was this great moment. You could see he was totally enjoying it and you know, swept away by it. And then he says, you know, I want to go back in the studio with these guys.
Sure.
That's great curation. That's
yeah,
like, that's not going to happen without that corporate money and without whoever is picking this and rounding up Black Ivory and Musique and Fonda Rae out mm-hmm of wherever they are.
Okay, so a quick sidebar while we're talking about festival curation. JP, you want to talk about Moog Fest a little bit? Because one of the things that I feel like Red Bull being in that space between commercially viable and curated sometimes misses, Moog Fest seems to not worry about that space because everybody that they invite seems to want to be involved in this highly curated space and is going to do something special for it. There were a lot of site-specific or festival-specific performances. Tell us a little bit about that experience of being there in that space while those shows were going on.
Well, Moog Fest is this bizarre hybrid because by day, it's a STEM and science technology, STEM and spirituality seminar. So you can go take the sacred healing sound bath, or you can study deep listening with a disciple of Pauline Oliveros, or you can hear a guy from MIT talk about the Swan Song Project, which involves sending a satellite out to a black hole that, if properly aimed, will slingshot it back into the past to warn humanity of all of its atrocities to come. That was a keynote speech, Joe Davis from MIT. And then you go to these four-hour durational performances where Haxan Cloke and Nick Zinner of the Yeah, Yeah, Yeahs sit around building a drone that they can take an hour on a single chord, and I can sit there and space out and watch the op art flicker.
That's not a touring concern. That's just a one-off performance, right?
Yeah, that's not going to happen again.
Godspeed.
But, I mean, in the evening there are touring acts, Animal Collective, Princess Nokia. That was pretty much their straight set.
Mm-hmm.
But when you see it in the context of all these drones and is music playing your brain and other kind of events, it makes you think about it differently. It's really the beauty of curation, which is to give this stuff a new context. I also want to big up the festival I went to earlier in April, the New Orleans Jazz Fest, which is also curation central.
Yeah.
We're in New Orleans. We're going to give you all of our best local guys. We're going to give you the Rebirth Brass Band and Aaron Neville. And we're going to give you the Cuban music that bounced across by radio waves that both sides were listening to. And we're going to give you Lord, because we need a pop person to sell some tickets. But basically, 80 or 90% of it is from New Orleans. It's your Berlitz total immersion in New Orleans for a weekend or two weekends. It's an aesthetic, and the stuff they bring in from Zimbabwe, a band called Mokumba, or from Cuba, makes you feel like, yes, I hear that New Orleans connection directly. It's really smart. It's really fun. The food's incredible. You can do this and make it a party. It's not a seminar. And MoGuest makes it a party too, but a lot geekier party.
So, smartly curated festivals. Anyway, catch me in Galax, Virginia for the Fiddle Fest later this summer, maybe. We'll see. Okay, back to Red Bull. Yeah, back to Red Bull. Do we at all worry about ceding some of this sort of like curatorial and critical authority to effectively an energy drink company? I mean, look, I don't know. We can maybe get Zach Wolf down here to talk about how patronage works in classical music, how it doesn't work. We've talked a little bit, Gio, about how it doesn't work in jazz music.
Right. You know,
should we just be grateful that anyone is doing this? Or should we be a little skeptical of the fact that this is all coming from, it's Red Bull. I don't drink it, just for the record.
Most of the people at the gigs didn't drink it either. Yeah, I saw people trying to give away the thing. It's like, oh, I bought, no, yeah, can you no, drink this?
Yeah, no. So, but should we be concerned about that?
I just think it depends on the quality of the curation. Mm-hmm. I mean, Red Bull could say, you know, get us five top 40 stars and we'll put a big Red Bull sign behind them. And
the Doritos stage at South by Southwest.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, the fact that they are doing a night of prepare yourselves for this. I've studied this tongue click. The fact that they are going to do a night of South African calm music. GQOM. The Q is the tongue click. This is like weird lo-fi underground
house.
deep house music. The fact that they're going to bring all these people from South Africa, only SoundCloud maniacs and international hipsters have really heard this stuff. Red Bull doesn't have to sponsor this. This is not like, oh, you know, here's Katy Perry for Red Bull.
Right. So, I think, but it fits, right? It fits a particular need.
It fits their profile. It makes them the club drink for when you're staying up all night listening to weird South African house music.
let's not have a Red Bull, but let's listen to some
please
GOM music. I'm just going to leave the click to y'all.
Uzihloniphe ngoba phela ngaphandle kwenhlonipho impela ngeke kuze kulungele ukuthi inhlonipho phambili yazi kunesiko lwakithi sisebenzisa inhlonipho kakhulukazi yebo ndodana iyabonga kakhulu.
Okay, so that was DJ Lag, who hails from South Africa. And a thing that the Red Bull Festival historically has done really well is understand that when it comes to dance and dance-oriented music, and I don't mean the sort of top 40 EDM stuff, I mean like global dance music culture, house music, post-house music, garage, techno, etc., that there's a global underground. And you saw it with that night this year. You saw it on the opening night with the Baile Funk stuff, MC Carol, who performed, and MC Bin Laden, who did not receive a visa and did not make it into the country, unfortunately. Right. You saw Moody Man, who was not doing a techno or house night, but he was doing Prince Night, which I was there. Gio, you were there as well. Okay, but all of this made me think, I don't know if any of you guys saw the interview that the co-founder of Red Bull gave a couple weeks before the beginning of... Okay, so it turns out that he is basically anti-migrant and anti-immigrant and, you know, is considering starting a media platform that some online was likened to potentially a European version of Breitbart.
Well, don't tell them who they're booking it.
Well, that's what I said. I was so surprised. Maybe not surprised is the wrong word, but I was so caught off guard that here is a music festival that seems to preach inclusive values and preach that everything is better if you can import ideas from all over the world into various cities. And it is run by a company that is co-founded by a person who apparently does not believe in similar values. I was very struck by that.
There's a Jonathan Swift quote, "The inattention of the powerful is our greatest asset."
Hey.
As long as that guy doesn't find out what his festival is booking, we're good.
Do you think that they listen to podcasts? I don't know.
But at the same time, what this does is it kind of heightens our attention to what is really ubiquitous, right? Which is all these contradictions and the fact that all these sponsorships are BS, you know? And, I mean, you've got the cool jazz festival, KOOL, in the 80s, right? One of the big festivals. And it was just like, we're literally playing this music that some people say, you know, is revolutionary music under a cigarette sign. Yep. And thank God we have some clarity here. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Because there's been the patron. You study the way that our history is played out since, you know, antiquity. I mean, it's been about patronage.
Of course.
But it's been, do we think about the way that oil paints, you know, to go back to John Berger here, the way that oil paint is really popular, partly because it depicted people's riches really with a lot of precision. Okay. We don't really have that in writing. You know, but we have Red Bull in writing, literally their stupid logo next to every single stage, except for the Ashram Singers at the Alice Coltrane show. They had the decency and actually the branding wherewithal not to do that.
That is smart. That is very smart. Because honestly, I wrote this in the intro to the piece, but literally every single time I looked at a Red Bull logo, I thought of this person's comments.
Right.
And I thought, oh, how perverse.
And that's
that
helpful.
We're celebrating this music. We're celebrating transnational music culture.
Right.
Under the auspices and with the good graces of someone who perhaps, if he was in the room, might not be thrilled.
And there's a really good article on a South African journal called The Con, C-O-N, about the exportation of GOM, this house music from Durban, to Britain and the way that it's been done sort of slyly and without a whole lot of, you know, flow back in the direction of the creators and of the home country. But it's hard to call that out really explicitly. Sometimes when you have a Red Bull logo and you say, man, how much are these artists getting paid? Can we put that on the record? You know, the more we can really trace it back, the more that it actually helps the conversation that we're trying to have.
I don't know if either of you guys have read DJ Rupture's book, but he does a little bit of writing in there about the role that Red Bull plays in global dance music culture and as a patron and what it chooses to support and what it doesn't choose to support. Obviously, you give material support to artists, you give them exposure, it's going to shape the larger narrative. I can't remember if it's in the book. I definitely saw him talk about it. I think he maybe had applied also, while he was struggling with it, had applied for a Red Bull grant or fellowship or whatnot, whatever those things are, and didn't get it. And that obviously complicates it even further. But go read DJ Rupture's book. Read it anyway. Yeah, just go cop that. But to go back to Alice Coltrane, before we go out, there's quite a moment right now around Alice Coltrane. Gio, you were there. Tell us a little bit about the show and also the broader context for what's happening with her right now.
Yeah, so there are artists, right, who have these ruptures in their careers. Elvis goes to Vegas, Dylan goes electric. There's, you know, these moments of bifurcation. Alice Coltrane had hers in, like, I think 1975. She decides to kind of go off the commercial recording grid in jazz and start a spiritual center in California. The Vedantic Center, a Hindu mystical sort of practice center, turns into an ashram elsewhere in the state. And she devotes the rest of her life to being a spiritual leader there, Swamini, Alice Coltrane, Turisangitananda. But this rupture isn't like the rest, because there was always so much spirituality and so much deliberate spiritual practice in her music before. And then, you know, you get to this period in your career and the music continues. It just goes slightly underground, you could say.
Slightly?
Very underground. It becomes...
By the cassettes of the ashram where you don't hear them.
Precisely. It becomes self-released cassettes that, you can't get anywhere. Couldn't really get on the web until just now. So anyway, this month, there was a collection that was put out. It's called World Spirituality Classics 1, the ecstatic music of Alice Coltrane Sangitananda, and it's the first kind of compilation of those recordings. So it's a moment to double back and celebrate this element of her career that people who'd been looking closely knew existed, but very few people had actually heard anything from. So the event was great because it drew those things together a little heavy-handedly, but, you know, that's what it mm-hmm. called for, probably. We had the Ashram Singers, who are still there. Reggie Workman, John, and Alice Coltrane's longtime associate, played bass with that group. He also played bass on the second set of the night, which was a jazz all-star group led by Ravi Coltrane, Alice's sort of esteemed son, who's a saxophone player, and the harpist, Brandy Younger, who's a huge Alice Coltrane scholar and devotee herself and fabulous musician. It was just a beautiful coming together of the many things that were her career.
Should we listen to some Alice Coltrane?
Yeah, let's listen to Om Shanti from okay. the new record.
Great.
Om Shanti Om Shanti Om Shanti Om Om Shanti Om Shanti Om Shanti Om Om Shanti Om Shanti Om Shanti Om.
Thank you for listening to the New York Times Popcast. Before we go this week, I just want to say a few words about what happened in Manchester a couple of nights ago. I go to concerts for a living, and concerts that privilege the needs and aesthetic desires and fantasy mind states of young women and young girls have been, in my experience, some of the safest spaces that I have ever been in as a music lover. And the idea that someone would choose to rip that asunder will never be anything other than horrifying. So given that, I, and on behalf of the entire music team here at the New York Times, want to offer condolences and strength to the people of Manchester and to all of Ariana Grande's fans who are hurting right now. Let's go out on a little bit of Ariana uplift with Baby I.
Deep inside of me, I don't know where to start.
Yeah.
I love you more than anything, but the words can't even touch what's in my heart.
You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. You can email us your questions and thoughts, podcast@nytimes.com. Subscribe to us at Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, anywhere you get your audio content. Our producer's Pedro Rosado. We're back next week.